From PRI, Public Radio International, and KCRW Santa Monica, this is To the Point.
Home ownership and the fading American dream. Hello again, I'm Warren Olney, and this is To the Point from Public Radio International, a daily look at the issues Americans care about most. Since the Great Depression, the U.S. government has encouraged home ownership most conspicuously with the homeowner's tax deduction. Now 6 million Americans are behind in their mortgage payments or facing foreclosure, but new federal programs may be doing more harm than good. Instead of help with mortgage modification or refinance, desperate homeowners face a blizzard of paperwork, official errors, with little or no supervision. Is home ownership all that it's cracked up to be? If not, what are the consequences for the economy and a cornerstone of American culture? On Reporter's Notebook later on, Pennsylvania's capital city declares bankruptcy. First, here's the news.
Support for To the Point comes from subscribers of KCRW Santa Monica and from the Public Radio International Program Fund, whose contributors include the Ford Foundation, the John D. and Catherine T. MacArthur Foundation, and the Rockefeller Foundation and its campaign for American workers. More at rockfound.org.
Hello again, Warren Olney, back with To the Point. The American dream of home ownership is in big trouble, and the Obama administration's efforts to help struggling homeowners are not working out. We'll hear what's going wrong and what it could mean for the future. On Reporter's Notebook, Harrisburg, Pennsylvania has filed for bankruptcy. What's happening to other towns and cities? First, this news update. In a Detroit federal court today, the so-called underwear bomber pleaded guilty to trying to blow up a plane to avenge what he called the U.S. wreckage of Muslim lands and property. The evidence against Umar Farouk Abdulmutallab was overwhelming. But there is some skepticism about yesterday's U.S. claim that Iran plotted to assassinate the Saudi ambassador to the U.S. on American soil, working through a Mexican drug cartel. Here's Attorney General Eric Holder.
The disruption of this alleged plot marks a significant achievement by our law enforcement and intelligence agencies, as well as the close cooperation of our partners in the Mexican government.
P.J. Crowley is a former State Department spokesperson from 2009 until earlier this year, now professor at George Washington University. Good to have you on our program.
Hello, Warren.
A lot of this sounds to many people, if nothing else, really stupid. They talked on cell phones. They lined up a Mexican drug cartel. Is this credible?
Well, it is credible. That said, obviously, you know, many in the business are struck by how ham-handed and amateurish it might be. I think an essential point here is what we seem to have a lot of evidence that suggests that, you know, a naturalized citizen in the United States was in contact with an operative in Iran. They hatched this plot. Some money exchanged hands, but is it a couple of guys? And we've seen these kinds of plots before where there's great aspiration but not necessarily great capability. The real question in terms of U.S. policymaking is, you know, if this plot was supported by and endorsed by members of Al-Quds, the Quds force in Iran, how high up the Iranian government was this knowledge or this approval? The higher up it goes, the more significant the consequences.
And Al-Quds is what?
Al-Quds is a special force inside the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps, and they are critical elements to the ability of the Iranian government to remain in power and to maintain both control of the population and execute its foreign policy. So the Iranian government and Al-Quds and the Iranian Revolutionary Guard Corps are attached at the hip.
So the big question then would be, as you say, how high up this would be, and that would, I assume, dictate American response.
Well, the American response will be limited in that, you know, but there can be great leverage that is gained from this. We've gone through different rounds of economic sanctions before over a variety of things, not only Iran's state sponsorship of terrorism, but also its nuclear ambitions. This will give additional leverage for the United States, other countries, including Saudi Arabia, to say to countries perhaps like China, that don't like to mix business and politics, that it's time to really continue to pressure and isolate Iran, because this goes beyond the pale. This is a violation of fundamental international norms that every country, the United States and every country in the world, has a responsibility to protect diplomats, you know, who are on their soil.
The Iranians, of course, are reacting furiously to this and say that it's a diversion from the Wall Street protests, which they are cheering on. They're all in favor of Occupy Wall Street as an example, as far as they're concerned, of how capitalism is failing. How significant is that kind of response?
Well, it's predictable. But it also could indicate that the higher-ups were as surprised to see this evolve as anybody else. And again, that's something that we don't know. But certainly the plot itself is consistent with the rivalry that is emerging in the region between Iran and Saudi Arabia. And it's manifesting itself in a place like Syria. So it's certainly not surprising that in this year of Arab transitions and in a place like Syria where you know, Saudi Arabia supporting the Sunni opposition and would love to see leadership in that country evolve from a Shia Alawite, you know, current, you know, leadership to a majority Sunni leadership. Syria is a client state of Iran, and they're trying desperately to preserve the rule of Bashar al-Assad. So, you know, if in this year of transition where Iran probably has lost a little bit of its mojo, if you will. They're looking to perhaps knock the Saudis off stride. In that kind of psychology, you could see a plot like this potentially emerge. But I think that at one level is significant. It just shows a country like Iran that is really uneasy about developments that are happening in the region and happening at their expense.
So it could have just been a couple of guys, or it might have been government involvement. We simply don't know as yet.
Well, I think there is government involvement, but if it's a mid-level thing, that's one thing. If it's something that's blessed at the highest levels of government in Iran, that's very, very, you know, very, very significant. I would draw a parallel like to Pakistan. We know after the bin Laden raid that somebody in the Pakistani government had to know. We just don't know how high up. I would say this is probably a similar situation, and there are some things we just have to find out before we really fully understand the gravity of what's happened here.
Okay. P.J. Crowley, formerly with the State Department, now at George Washington University. Always good to have you on our program.
Thank you, Warren.
In a moment, home ownership and the fading American dream on To The Point.
To The Point thanks Factiva from Dow Jones for its use of Factiva.com. With news and information from 10,000 global sources, Factiva is a resource for companies whose continued success rests upon timely strategic news on their industry, competitors, and themselves.
Warren, I'll be back with To The Point. In the aftermath of the housing market collapse and the subprime mortgage scandal, President Obama promised help for millions of homeowners trying to avoid foreclosures. That hasn't happened.
And so we're going back to the drawing board, talking to banks, trying to put some pressure on them to work with people who have mortgages to see if we can make further adjustments, modify loans more quickly, and also see if there may be circumstances where reducing principal is appropriate.
Paul Keel with the nonprofit news service ProPublica has reported extensively on the failure of one of the president's plans. It's called the Home Affordable Modification Plan, or HAMP. It was designed to help 3 or 4 million homeowners avoid foreclosure, but it hasn't turned out that way. Paul Keel, welcome to our program.
Thanks for having me.
What's going wrong?
Well, a lot of things have gone wrong. It was funny listening to Obama talking about putting pressure on the banks. I mean, this is a program that was launched as part of the TARP in the spring of 2009. The plan was to take about $50 billion of the TARP and put that towards some sort of program that would keep people out of foreclosure and in their homes through modifying the loans. And, I mean, from the beginning, it's been pretty obvious that the banks are not following the rules of the program. There have been widespread reports. I mean, I've talked to literally thousands of people who've tried to go through this process. It's something of a marathon for homeowners just to get, you know, kind of answers that make sense. In 2009, it was hard to get even anybody on the phone. And, you know, last week we were able to get a hold of some of the audit reports that the government had been doing of the banks of the program. And basically what they showed is there really was very little to no oversight for the first 8 months of the program. And then when there was oversight, they were finding major problems, but they essentially were not, you know, making much of a fuss over it. We found that, you know, in a sample of loans, they found that they had miscalculated the homeowner's income in about 80% of cases. And the approach has been kind of, you know, can you fix this? Here's some, you know, this is what's wrong. Do you have a plan to fix this? This sort of thing is kind of back and forth, this private back and forth, not kind of a bully pulpit type type of approach that you might expect for some program that's really a central part of the administration's plan for somehow dealing with this housing mess.
So if you're saying that if they had been serious about it or if they had done it right, they would have been out loud and said, we're finding these problems, here's what we're doing about it, and putting pressure on the banks in that way?
Right. I mean, it's something that going back to 2009, it's been obvious there have been problems, and, you know, certain oversight people like the Inspector General for the TARP is big, you know, what penalties do you have? What are you going to do if they don't follow the rules of the program? You know, what steps are you going to take? And they've never been clear about that. Until this year, they took kind of a small step in withholding some of these subsidies from the biggest banks. But, you know, that's 2 years into the program. The point in time when this program could have made, you know, an enormous difference was 2009, 2010, when you had a backlog of, you know, millions of people who are going through this program, and they didn't have the benefit of a program that, you know, worked the way it was supposed to.
So the way that it's set up, I take it, is that some TARP money, $50 billion, goes then to subsidies to the banks, and then the banks are supposed to renegotiate mortgages with people, and if they have a loss, they get to take it out of that $50 billion?
It's basically the idea is they're just supposed to be making a calculation, and the calculation is, does it make financial sense to give this person a break on their mortgage? You know, it's not a charity program. It's supposed to be a hard-nosed economic. There's a very complicated formula behind it, and they're deciding, does it make more sense to foreclose on this person or to give this person, you know, a lower interest rate, and they can do other things to adjust the mortgage. So that's the key thing to keep in mind. The incentives were basically, the idea was that the banks didn't have enough financial incentive, and investors behind the loans didn't have enough financial incentive to consider, you know, modification as a reasonable way to avoid foreclosure. And it was kind of this idea, well, the free market, you know, just needs a little bit of help here, and, you know, the right incentives will be in place and then things will work, but that hasn't been borne out.
Well, how many people have, in fact, been helped?
The original, you know, program was touted as being able to modify 3 to 4 million people's mortgages. At this point, you know, more than 2.5 years into it, we're a little bit over 800,000 total that have got a modification through the program. I mean, if you consider the fact that there are 2 million people in foreclosure now, there's 2 more million people who are at least 2 months behind on the mortgage. There's another 2 million who are 30 days or more behind on the mortgage. You know, it hasn't been a very powerful weapon.
Has there been resistance from the banks? Or I guess the Treasury Department was administering this. Has there been a bureaucratic, you indicated there was a sort of a bureaucratic laissez-faire attitude?
Right. I mean, there haven't been public resistance by the banks. But, I mean, if you look at their actions, I mean, this is an area of banking, mortgage servicing. It's always been kind of a backwater. You know, traditionally, you know, you collect someone's payments. If they fall behind, you foreclose on them, and that's kind of all there was to it. You know, with housing prices collapsing the way they do, foreclosure was no longer, you know, the obvious best step to take for as far as the investor is concerned. So, you know, the idea is that this sort of industry needed a kind of overhaul, and this program was supposed to be the way to do it. But the banks still, they really don't have the incentive to put the adequate resources into this type of thing. They're basically throwing, you know, people making, you know, $12 an hour, really outdated systems. You know, these are people in call centers, sometimes people in India. And, you know, what happened from that is kind of makes sense, you know, if you understand that's what is on the other end of it. I mean, it's just been people like sending their documents in, faxing their documents in. Those documents being received has been like a huge problem, which is just a simple customer service, you know, thing that, you know, is not that hard to tackle.
Again, Paul Keel is a reporter for ProPublica, and we've been talking about HAMP, which is designed to try to help people who are facing foreclosure. There's another program, which is abbreviated HARP, and that's for people who aren't behind in their mortgage, but who are sufficiently underwater that they want to refinance under various guidelines. Simbri Ross is a Washington, D.C. homeowner for 14 years. She's a lawyer, a former government attorney, currently looking for a job, and she tried to get help from HARP. Simbri Ross, thanks a lot for being on our program.
Thank you for having me.
What was it like?
Well, I had actually tried to have assistance, government assistance under the Making Home Affordable program, HAMP, and also the Home Savers program. It's been a very frustrating experience, one that I would liken to being kicked while you're down.
Describe it in a little more detail.
Well, when I applied for the HAMP program, initially I was given wrong information from my bank, Capital One. In June 2010, when that program first came to my attention, Capital One indicated that it did not participate in the HAMP program. At that time, it actually did participate, but I did not learn that until the latter part of August in 2010. Thereafter, I was able to speak to someone who had accurate information, received the necessary paperwork for the HAMP program, returned it in terms of a completed application in early September, but was subsequently denied a modification through that program the day before Thanksgiving. With the Home Savers program, a program where your mortgage is paid in its entirety for 15 months, it's necessary for your bank to participate in the program or sign a participation agreement. When I learned of that program this June 2011, my bank, Capital One, did not participate in the program, so that there was no way for me to benefit from that program until a participation agreement was signed by Capital One.
So you're a lawyer, and you had trouble of various kinds. Was it difficult? Did you have the same kinds of issues that DePaul Keel just described, getting people on the phone, getting them to give you a straight answer?
Yes, very much so, especially with the HAMP program initially. When Capital One indicated that it did not participate, I was dealing with a customer service representative who did not seem to know the type of program I was speaking about or its employers' participation in that program, HAMP. When I subsequently tried to clarify information, again, I was not given forthright information, and there were miscalculations, in my opinion, in terms of my financial eligibility for that program.
You've had your home for 14 years, as I understand.
Yes.
So you didn't expect to need this kind of help. How disappointed or what's your attitude, I guess I should say now, toward the government for which you have been an attorney? What's wrong with this? What's happened?
My view of the government is not adversely affected. My view of the bank had been not favorable. I think that my best description of how I feel about the government is a lack of oversight. And I would hope that the government could compel banks to participate in programs that they are mandated to participate in. I think for me that would have made a great deal of difference in the initial handling of my HAMP application had there been more government oversight. And I also think subsequently with my Home Savers application, had there been more government oversight, Capital One would have signed that agreement earlier, and I would not be behind in my mortgage payments now.
Cimbri Ross, again, Washington, D.C. homeowner for 14 years, former government attorney, now out of work. Paul Keel, back to you with ProPublica. So this is the kind of thing that you're talking about. It's a lack of oversight, a lack of keeping track of the program, and simply sort of letting it slide.
Yeah, that's been, I mean, it's been really frustrating for people. You know, they figure, you know, this is such an easy thing. You know, I have the right documents. I qualify for the program. Why can't I get this to work? And just even figure out who to call, you know, what steps do you take? You know, there's not really a clear appeals process, or there's, you know, there are certain things, steps you can take that I recommend people take. But it's sort of an uncharted area, and that alone can be very frustrating.
Now, you were only able to get a hold of the records from one of the lenders, GMAC, not from any of the others. So transparency is still an issue.
Yeah, it's really still an issue. And, I mean, GMAC is the fifth largest servicer, but you have banks like Bank of America, which is just gigantic because they, you know, they ate up Countrywide. I mean, they service something like 13 million loans. You have the Chase and Wells Fargo and Citi, and yeah, so they blocked the release of those documents. We're still trying to get a hold of them because what they show, I think, is pretty clear. But yeah, I mean, the Treasury Department has been kind of proud of what the statistics that they have released. This was an area where there really was, I mean, absolutely zero transparency before, and so now we have a little more idea. But as far as transparency of oversight, that's something that we've really had to fight for.
Paul Keel again with ProPublica. Let's talk a bit about the history of the government's involvement with housing. Alyssa Katz is author of Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us, She's also editor of the New York World publication out of the Columbia Journalism School. Alyssa Katz, good to have you on our program.
Thanks for having me.
Take us back a bit. How long has the government been involved in home ownership, generally speaking, not doing what it's what we've heard described, but rather encouraging home ownership as a very important part of American life and the economy?
Well, government first got involved in a crisis not all that different from the present one. In the Great Depression, the Roosevelt administration created something called the Homeowners Loan Corporation to deal with exactly the kind of situations homeowners are dealing with now, especially owing more than their homes are worth and having trouble making their payments. And so Homeowners Loan Corporation was a government program that allowed homeowners to refinance their homes at a level they could afford and that was closer to the actual value of their properties, and it saved millions of Americans from foreclosure. And it was the success of that program that then led to something called the Federal Housing Administration. And this is, I think we all know about the great boom in housing and home ownership that happened in the 1950s. Well, this was made possible by FHA, which was a government insurance program that essentially told banks, if you make a loan to help someone buy a house in one of these new suburbs, we will guarantee that you'll be paid back even if that buyer runs into trouble. And it was that insurance program that really enabled millions of Americans to become homeowners who otherwise couldn't have borrowed the money to do that.
And, of course, we now have also the homeowners tax exemption.
That's right. And that has a history that goes back just about as far. And so what we had was this enormous precedent of government coming in and providing both a backstop and also very powerful financial incentives to promote home ownership, which originally started out as an economic program to jumpstart the economy when it was in the Depression, you know, as a way of getting out, but quickly turned into a kind of major political and social project where Americans came to understand that home ownership was not only the American dream, but also something that government would help them accomplish, and that this then became the basis of the explosive growth of real estate and banking industries to really support this huge opportunity that people were able to take advantage of.
Alyssa Katz, once again, author of Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us, editor of the New York World, published out of the Columbia Journalism School. We're going to continue this conversation with her and our other guests as well as soon as we take a very brief break. On Reporter's Notebook a bit later, Pennsylvania's capital city has filed for bankruptcy. We'll look at the plight of American cities and towns. Back in a moment with To the Point from PRI.
A complete archive of past programs is available online at kcrw.com/to the point. You can also order a CD copy by calling 1-888-600-5279.
Warren Olney back with To the Point. We've just heard first that the current program by the Obama administration to try to help homeowners is not working. We heard the president himself saying it's back to the drawing board. And we've heard about a program during the Great Depression and during and after the Great Depression that did work and contributed enormously to the growth of the economy. Alyssa Katz, could the Obama administration simply have adopted the same tactics that were used back in the 30s, or are things just enormously more complicated, particularly because of the subprime mortgage issue?
Yeah, no, the circumstances the Obama administration faced were quite different than those Roosevelt faced. And the important difference, in fact, was that we're better off now in one sense, and that is that the banks have not collapsed, and in fact that the unlike in the Depression, where really the major banks that had done home lending were wiped out, here the main task of the Treasury Department was to make sure that the financial institutions were able to stay alive and able to avoid complete collapse. And so that is really the circumstance that has boxed the Obama administration in, because the same Treasury Department that's responsible for maintaining the health of the financial institutions is the same agency that's also running these foreclosure prevention programs. And so while in presenting Making Home Affordable and other programs to the public, Treasury is saying, well, this, we are here to help homeowners, the larger truth in Treasury does not ultimately deny this, is that they, as a major priority, have to help the banks. And if they are to do things that would really help homeowners in a significant way, and especially reducing principal for borrowers who are deep underwater and owe more than their homes are worth, if they were to do that at a systematic scale, there's a genuine fear that this would prove very harmful to the stability of banks and therefore the financial system. And that fear has really driven the creation of all of these programs that don't really work. And so when Paul is describing the failures and shortcomings of Making Home Affordable, it is not simply a matter that the servicers are not properly staffed or not fully competent or any of the other very real issues there. It's also that these programs by design don't push financial institutions, or don't require them certainly, to make the kinds of concessions that would make a substantial difference on a large scale for homeowners.
So let me go back to Assembly Ross, our Washington, D.C. homeowner for 14 years, former government attorney, now trying to get some help from the government in keeping her home. Does that make sense to you, that the Treasury Department has a kind of conflict here, that on the one hand, it's supposed to help the banks and maintain their financial health, and on the other, it's supposed to help homeowners who may not have the same interests?
I really can't speak to the issues regarding Treasury. I can only speak to my experience in dealing with Capital One Bank. But I am very thankful in terms of dealing with this situation to have the National Community Reinvestment Coalition working on my behalf through Kobe Pruitt, an advocate with that organization, to try to resolve the situation on my behalf.
Well, you have just done my job by introducing our next guest. It's not the person you referred to, but John Taylor, who's president and CEO of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. Again, organizations around the country that are trying to expand fair housing and fair access to capital and to credit as well. John Taylor, good to have you on our program.
Oh, good to be here. Thank you.
How is this all coming down in terms of home ownership by various categories of people in the United States, by age group, by ethnicity, and by other kinds of measurements?
Well, let me say first a broader statement that there simply is not going to be an economic recovery in the United States if there isn't a housing recovery. Hasn't been one since the 30s. We won't see one now, and I think your three previous guests, including your reporter, I think did a very good job in describing what is happening and what is not happening. And except to just add specifically that in the last 16 months, we've had 4 million more foreclosure filings. So we're not getting ahead of this problem, and we have at least another 8 million more foreclosures to go on top of the 4 million we've just seen. So everybody's being impacted by this. The loss of equity and wealth, obviously disproportionately, people of color have been hit the hardest. It's been amazing the amount of wealth that they've lost through the equity that they had in their homes, disproportionately. For Latinos and for African Americans, it's close to the 40% and 50%. I think for Latinos, almost 66% of the equity has been lost in just a period of a few years as a result of this crisis. For most white people in America, they've lost on average a 16% of their equity. So this has hit everybody and continues to hit everybody in all age groups, in all races. And it's becoming next to impossible unless you have tremendous amount of savings to get into the housing market. The earlier speakers spoke about FHA and other government programs that have helped people. They left out the GI Bill. How many people in our middle class today owe it to the GI Bill with these very low interest loans, and you didn't even have to come up with a down payment at the time. You could pay that out over the course of your loan. Who owe their ability to build wealth and own a home and be able to flip that home and go to a bigger house and build equity and then start businesses with that equity and from that home. I mean, a lot of people have a lot to thank the government for in this whole effort to build home ownership, and to do it in a safe and sound and responsible, sustainable manner.
One of your goals is fair housing and fair access to capital and credit. Tell us about that.
Right. So what has happened is up until about the end of the 90s, essentially, if you were black, white, brown, yellow, whatever color of person you were, you essentially would get access to credit at the same rates and terms and conditions as everybody else. They were prime loans. Unfortunately, a segment of the industry figured out that you could do these subprime loans and charge people more, get higher fees, charge higher interest rates, and they had a willing Wall Street that was had an interest in securitizing those loans so these brokers and lenders could sell them, be done with them, and they became pretty much concerned more about the upfront fee and less about the idea of that mortgage performing. In the old days, banks used to keep these loans on their books, what they call in portfolio, and they'd be very concerned about whether the homeowner was making the monthly payments or not. In the case of brokers and others who were able to just get these loans made and then have them purchased by Wall Street, all they cared about is if the homeowner made the payments for the first 3 months, because after 3 months they would get their fee and then they'd be done with it. So what happened is they really targeted communities, and this was really not about new home ownership. It's a misnomer. People think all this was about increasing home ownership and pushing people into homes. This really was a refinance boom. And then a way of taking people who are already existing homeowners and putting them in a bigger home. So it had little to do with actually helping new homeowners to come into the market. In fact, in the mid-90s, you look at what Fannie and Freddie did, you saw the biggest jumps in home ownership rates for African Americans in both 93 and 94, 50% jump in each year in originations. In both cases, those were 100% prime loans, very sustainable, responsible loans, made to people who had the ability to pay with no funny money terms and conditions or things that were unsustainable. So, you know, I think that the way the system morphed, in particular in the unregulated portion of the system, particularly with independent mortgage companies like Ameriquest, New Century, Countrywide, Option One, these weren't banks. These were just people who were dealing essentially with other people's monies, investors who thought they were buying securities that were good securities but didn't realize they were full of a lot of this unsustainable, high-risk, changing terms and conditions, adjustable rates, and balloon payments and all these things that made these loans, put a great jeopardy on them. But they didn't know what was happening is the appraisers, the brokers, and all the people in the front end of this were all getting their fees and their money and care less of how these things performed. So, they targeted communities of color, and you went from having where subprime loans used to constitute 1 or 2% of a neighborhood, you'd see these rates in the inner cities where 40% of the loans made there were subprime loans. And when you look at these loans at hindsight, the majority of them were people who could have gotten prime loans, but that's what was available to them. That's what got pitched to them with teaser rates and other encouraging characteristics in these loans that didn't really reveal the riskiness and the expensiveness of these loans. So there were a lot of people were sold a bill of goods thinking they were getting good loans.
And this was also advertised as a spread of home ownership into communities that previously hadn't been able to afford homes, wasn't it?
Yes, absolutely. And it was, but on the other hand, it really, as I said, 9 out of 10 of these loans were really either refinances or to people who already had loans. So actually a very small percentage of it went to new homeowners. I did want to mention, because this has come up in your conversation with the three previous speakers, the fundamental difference in this mortgage program that this both the Bush administration and the Obama administration has come out with, and Lisa alluded to this at one point, and that is these programs were voluntary, and that was the fundamental flaw in these programs. They weren't mandatory, and I think that is lenders didn't have to participate in these government programs, HAMP and HOP, as you referred to them. And furthermore, when you look at when Roosevelt in the 30s, that was the best example of a similar circumstance that we had, where millions of American homeowners were about to lose their homes or their farms. Unlike this president and President Bush, President Roosevelt got on TV and said, I am not going to tolerate these foreclosures. I am declaring a moratorium on foreclosures. Now, he didn't really have that authority, except to the extent that banks would do what the president said in those days. This president has tried to do the same thing. Banks are not doing it. They don't care about it. Services are not doing it. Investors are not doing it. And worse than that, Fannie and Freddie, which is on the government conservatorship, is not doing it. So, you know, I think the president's hot and request is in the right place. And the problem is the atmosphere has changed now, where in the old days, you know, when a president said, look, I want to stop the foreclosures, let's get these people new loans and keep them in their homes. We want responsible homeowners with terms and conditions and loans that fit their ability to pay. This president has tried to do the same thing, but he's done it with a voluntary compliance component rather than simply making it mandatory. Okay. And using not only the bully pulpit, but using the Federal Reserve and Treasury to leverage these guys to come to the table and modify these loans. Everybody's sitting on the side waiting for everybody else to modify so that their portfolio suffers the least amount of hit from a modification or a refinance or a write-down.
John Taylor again, President and CEO of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. Alyssa Katz, let me go back to you because I believe this is true of all of you, but you've looked at census data, and in addition to showing the gap between whites and minorities growing, whereas it was decreasing previously, it also shows a big gap between old and young people owning homes. Why is that so important?
Well, what we're seeing, right, is that that there's not only a huge gap, but there's significant declines in just the past few years in the number of households headed by someone who's under age 35 that owns a home. So in 2005, it was about 43%. We're now down to 37.5% of householders under 35 owning their homes, and there's no sign of that changing. So this means a couple of things. It means, first of all, that young people are not moving into home ownership, but more important, it's suggesting to us that we have two things going on. One is that people are trying to become homeowners, would like to be, but cannot get a mortgage because lenders, in large part because Fannie Mae and Freddie Mac have become so cautious in their underwriting standards that lenders are simply not making loans to people unless they're bringing a lot of cash to the table, as I think John said before. And so for young people, it's just very, very difficult to come up with the down payment or have the kind of work history and salary history and credit score that lenders are looking for right now. So that door is simply not open for a lot of younger people. And I think, and this is more anecdotal, but I think what we also see happening on a large scale across the country is that a lot of younger people are also opting not to be homeowners. And you see some signs of this in surveys that Fannie Mae does every year that asks people about their attitudes toward home ownership and their intentions to become homeowners. Would you like to be a homeowner, but you can't, or are you choosing not to be a homeowner? And over the past few years, we've seen more younger people saying, well, no, I actually would prefer to rent right now. And I think this overlaps with a lot of interest among young people in living in cities where far greater share of the population does rent and where renting is a more tolerable way of living. I mean, you really have to remember that renting is not always an equal choice between renting and ownership. Often renting is it means that you're going to be getting a home of lesser quality or an inferior location or dealing with a bad landlord. For people to really want to choose to rent, it really has to be a more attractive option. And I think what we're seeing is young people choosing to rent in cities where they have some protections as tenants, there is some decent rental housing to choose from, and they can do this as an affirmative choice.
And if John Taylor is right that there won't be an economic recovery unless there is a housing recovery, this would not bode well for the future, it seems to me, if young people are not getting into the housing business.
Well, I think that's right, and I think that the key thing that needs to happen now to make any dent in the trends among young people is to get reform of housing finance moving on a sane track. I mean, you've had what is a very promising proposal from the Obama administration to look forward to the role of government in supporting a healthy mortgage market so that people with middle-class incomes, with decent credit ratings, and who are clearly safe propositions to lend to, can know they can go in and get a long-term mortgage that will let them go ahead and buy a home.
Yeah, John Taylor, excuse me for interrupting, but we don't have a lot of time left, and I wanted to get back to your organization, the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. Cimbri Ross said earlier that you've been a lot of help to her. What do you do for people, and what do you advise people to do?
Well, we're essentially a trade association of 600 community organizations that each of which work with consumers like Ms. Ross all around the country, and we also do some direct services as we did for Ms. Ross in the way of counseling and foreclosure prevention. We do a lot of small business lending and development. Mostly what we do is we try to get the government to pay attention to solutions and ideas which we think would be more effective in helping people. And so we spend a lot of time with Congress, with the national press, with the bank regulatory agencies, with think tanks and others, trying to get them to see the perspective of what's happening in underserved communities. You asked about home ownership rates for, you know, what was happening in minority communities, and I didn't finish the answer to say, you know, right now home ownership rates for African Americans are about 44%, for Hispanics 46%, and you know, according to the U.S. Bureau of Census, that's less than it was 10 years ago, and they're Wow. predicting that, you know, home ownership rates are going to for those populations are going to drop down to 40%, which will be worse than it was, you know, 40 years ago. So we're heading in the wrong direction for them, for new families. And in fact, there's a lot of conversation about whether or not home ownership is for everybody and for, you know, and the an important investment or a way to build wealth.
So Cimbri, I'm sorry to interrupt you. Cimbri Ross, is home ownership still part of the American dream, do you think? Do you feel that way? Do your friends feel that way?
My friends are reviewing their decisions, and I think many of them now might have bought condos or co-ops. So a home as a primary investment, I think for many people, might not be the American dream.
Okay. Well, thank you all very much for being on our program. I'm sorry that we are out of time. I'm sure our listeners want to know more, but thank you all. Cimbri Ross, again, 14-year Washington, D.C. homeowner, described her problems with the current government programs. John Taylor, President, CEO of the National Community Reinvestment Coalition. Alyssa Katz, her book, Our Lot, How Real Estate Came to Own Us, and she's also editor of the New York World at Columbia Journalism School. Paul Keel is a reporter for ProPublica, who has been studying this issue for a long, long time. Thank you all very much for being on our program today. We'll come back and address this subject again in the future. It's been 20 years since Orange County, California, filed bankruptcy under what's called Chapter 9. Now, Harrisburg, the capital of Pennsylvania, has invoked that little-used provision of the bankruptcy code. Are other cities in trouble, too? We'll be back in a moment with that. To the point.
For more information about To The Point or to sign up for the free podcast, visit kcrw.com/To The Point.
Warren Alnebach with Reporter's Notebook on To The Point. Harrisburg says it cannot continue providing critical services at the same time it's paying off $300 million in debt for an incinerator project. The city council's attorney says Chapter 9 will give it bargaining power with creditors and with the state of Pennsylvania, which is considering a takeover of its capital city. Michael Pagano is dean of the College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs at the University of Illinois at Chicago. Professor, thank you very much for being on our program.
My pleasure. Thank you for having me.
First of all, quickly, what is Chapter 9?
Chapter 9 is part of the federal tax code that allows local governments to file for bankruptcy if their states permit them to do so. So for most of the states do not permit their local governments to file Chapter 9 bankruptcy. Only a few states actually permit the states to go, the cities to go directly there, and California is one of those.
Why do some states do it and others not?
Well, this is part of the federalism legacy of the United States. States are sovereigns just as the United States are sovereigns, and the United States can't do anything that would in any way jeopardize the existence of a state. And so when the tax code was written, all tax codes are written in a way that protects and preserves the sovereign immunity of states.
And bankruptcy is a federal matter.
Well, it is, but it's also a state matter. When it's local governments, it's a state matter. All local governments are creatures of their states. The states can abolish them and create them at will. So they have a special constitutional, state constitutional inherent responsibility and right.
Okay. So what about the general question here? How many Harrisburgs are there around the country who can't pay their bills?
Those are two different questions. There are very, very few Harrisburgs. I'd be surprised if we find many other bankruptcies, even in these tough fiscal times, only for two important reasons. One is that most states don't allow their municipalities to go to the federal courts for Chapter 9. But the other reason is that, most importantly, cities and counties and other local governments are responsible for balancing their budget. And that requires them to raise taxes and fees or reduce spending or reorganize or seek some protection under state laws. So in Harrisburg's case, Harrisburg happened not because of the recession, which we're currently suffering, but because of a previous investment from many years ago that turned out to not generate the income that they thought it might. So in terms of in terms of your broader question, how many more Harrisburgs? I would be surprised if we find many at all.
Okay.
If we do, they would be in the areas of what we call general governments, cities and counties. Most cities and counties will do fine.
What about state bankruptcies? We won't see those either?
No, states aren't permitted to bankrupt. Again, states
some
are sovereign.
Some states are.
States are sovereign. They can not pay their creditors.
No. I didn't mean that. I meant what about other cities going to bankruptcy under state laws rather than federal laws?
Well, what they go under what is considered to be something like a takeover. So what the states do is they send their own people in to manage the fiscal affairs of those cities or counties or school districts. And that's I would not be surprised if there was more activity on that front. But it's different from Chapter 9 bankruptcy.
So it's not protection of the same kind. It's, management change as much
That's
as anything.
That's correct. Mm-hmm.
Are cities in trouble because of the recession? Harrisburg maybe not, but is that what's concerning you about other cities around the country?
Oh, yes. We have now observed for 4 years now a decline in revenue to the general funds of municipalities, which is the longest streak of year-over-year decline in revenue that we've seen since the Great Depression. So, yes, cities are suffering from a severe fiscal crisis right now, but I don't believe that one of the responses will be to declare bankruptcy, and if so, it would be very, very rare.
On the other hand, how likely are they to increase taxes?
Well, to the extent that they can, there may be some of that. There's a lot of adjustment on the expenditure side. I think we're seeing a lot of municipalities and counties now rethinking their entire fiscal architecture. That is, do we have the right combination of taxes and fees to support the services and the service levels that our citizens want? And I think we're seeing a lot more of that conversation than we've seen in a long time.
We just had a long conversation about the housing crisis and what the federal government is trying to do about that and how unsuccessful it's been. Has the housing crisis impacted city employees? A lot of them are being laid off. There's a big move to reduce pensions. Is that a problem for the people who are city employees?
Yes, and in fact, reduction in city employment is an activity that the majority of cities around the country have actually resorted to in this last year and even the year before. So municipal employment, that is employment directly by the city, has been declining over the last 2 years. Part of it is because of the housing market. Property tax receipts are down this year. And remember, property tax receipts lag the recession. So when your house, the value of your house declines, it doesn't show up on your tax bill for around 18 to 24 months or longer. So we are now seeing the effect of the decline of the real estate market in the city treasuries. But the other part of the reason that the city treasuries are losing money is that consumer confidence is still not strong. So cities that have access to the sales tax, of which more than half of American municipalities do, are seeing an actual decline in sales tax receipts. And even the 1 in 10 cities that have access to the income tax, because income has remained fairly stagnant or declining in some cases, we're seeing that income tax receipts are declining as well.
Michael Pagano, again, Dean of the College of Urban Planning and Public Affairs, University of Illinois at Chicago. Thank you so much for being on our program.
Thank you very much.
Program produced today by Caitlin Schamberg with Katie Cooper and Sonia Geis. I'm Warren Olney. Join us again for To the Point, produced live and podcast, co-production of KCRW Santa Monica and Public Radio International.
PRI, Public Radio International.